Welcome back to Equity Merchants. Our guest for today is Nneka Eze, the Managing Director and General Partner at Vested World. Previously, she was a partner at Dalberg, where she led the firm's agricultural practice. Today, she joins me to discuss Vested World's criteria for investment, when startups are ready for investment, and her hopes for Africa's future. Welcome to the discussion. So, could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, definitely. My name is Nneka Eze. I'm a managing director and general partner at Vested World, which is a fund investing in East and West Africa in impactful businesses in agriculture, consumer, and of course, technology as well.
Can you share your journey to this point? What have you done in the past that led you to Vested World?
Yeah, it's actually something I've been reflecting on, and one of our team members has been pushing me to write about. So I guess it's something we can go into. But don't worry, I won't scoop your article too much at least. I guess, you know, the real reason I moved into venture is because it felt so impactful in terms of being able to invest your money, your time, and your sort of influence or expertise, your networks in companies that were trying to grow and really change Africa in a lot of ways. So I think that's really why I moved into it. But I would say when I first started working on the continent in 2008, I was working with a financial institution in Nigeria. And it was pretty clear to me that the types of transactions that they were working on, which was generally looking at large corporates, oil and gas, was not going to help drive change in the country. And so there was also, of course, a big financial crisis that happened in Nigeria, the next year. And I think that really influenced my perspective on finance and how I thought I could actually play a role. I then, of course, served a number of financial institutions in East Africa after moving to Kenya in 2009 and saw similar challenge. I think one of the biggest of the institutions in East Africa nowadays is Equity Bank. At the time, they were still sort of a mid-market, mid-tier bank, and of course now are one of the largest banks, but you could see that their model was very different than others. And I was really interested to see what other types of finance could really help unlock economic development and growth across the continent. And so while I was in consulting for about 14 years, working across the continent, I think I was always interested in investing and really started investing personally into companies. And then, you know, through that sort of found my way into becoming part of the investment committee of Vested World over the last 4.5 or so years. And that's really how I ended up joining. So I am a partner, but this is my first VC job. So hopefully can provide some reflections on that transition into venture, as well as, you know, what we're seeing across the ecosystem.
You spent quite some time working in both financial institutions and management consulting. What would you say was like the biggest difference when you finally made the move to VC?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest difference is one that I comment on frequently. I was always in a client service role. So I was a strategy consultant working within a financial institution or for a country government or a foundation. But I would say the sector writ large is quite male dominated, and it's something that is very visible. If you look at reporting in the sector, if you look at who's leading deal teams, who's leading funds, it's definitely much more male dominated than the sector that I'm coming from. And so I think that is definitely something that has stood out pretty significantly. And then I think the other thing is just this
alignment of interests, which is part of what attracted me to investing, where you want your companies that you're invested in and the founders, the management team members, to do good work, to build their teams, to, you know, scale their companies, of course, to return the invested capital. But I think that alignment in terms of sort of mission and goals, I think is really critical. And I like that as well. Those are probably the two big ones.
All right. So you started investing personally before you got into Vested World. So what was the first investment and what did that feel like? Also, what guides your investment in, your personal investment in startups?
Yeah, I mean, my first investment, it's interesting. I mean, in terms of actual cash investment, it was probably into a company in East Africa that was doing like agricultural finance, invoice factoring. I think there it was just because I knew the team and they needed money to invest. And so I said, I'll invest. I ended up exiting that transaction, you know, maybe a year and a half or 2 years later. Unfortunately, that company ended up, it's winding down. But I think I generally had been investing into companies where I knew somebody or got to know somebody over a period of time. So even if they came with me to invest, I usually wanted to get to know them as an individual, even if I didn't know them historically. And then at my former firm, I led the agriculture and food security practice for, you know, 7+ years. And so I had a lot of agriculture experience and really expertise. And so I would say most of my portfolio ended up being into agri-processing, agribusiness companies across, you know, East and West Africa. So I've invested in a number of companies in Nigeria, one in Cameroon, and all of those have been in agri-processing. And then, you know, more recently have invested in a fintech that's, you know, looking at expanding access to finance for microfinance institutions in West Africa, and hopefully we'll expand beyond that. But yeah, I think mostly I've been looking at agribusiness, just given some of my past histories. But yeah.
So do you mind sharing the startups you've invested in, especially the ones that are still working?
Yeah, I guess I can. I'll mention a few of them. You know, it's okay. Not really out there in the domain, so okay. I guess I'm gonna have to make sure they do really well. one company is called Grassland Africa. They're based in Cameroon and have a really impressive CEO who, you know, had to deal with quite a lot. So originally the company was based in Bamenda, which, you know, is really close to the Nigerian border. There's been a lot of challenges in that region with the government, and it's really led to challenges with agricultural productivity. So they had to actually move, you know, move their operations across country, and then essentially start again, developing relationships with farmers and building up their own processing and drying capacity. So that one's been rocky, but, you know, doing well now, which I think is a testament to the resilience of a lot of the founders that I seem to have invested in. Another one, and this is actually how I met the Vested World team, was in a company called Tomato Joss, based now in Kaduna in northern Nigeria. So I got to know Mira, the CEO, when we were both doing projects in Ethiopia many years ago. And of course, I'd done a lot of work on the tomato value chain. I did the strategy work that led to the Fund for Agrofinance in Nigeria, FAFIN, being launched. And so very much knew the tomato value chain from a lot of that work and other projects on Nigeria, and was excited about what they were trying to build. So made an investment in them. I invested in a company called Reach, which is a information sort of focused fintech that's really helping to get information to people on their daily expenses, help them be better at managing their finances and live a more sort of sustainable life. And obviously can be challenging in the face of a lot of the messaging around consumer culture, but they've been quite a good investment. They've been able to weather the storms of COVID, pivot in terms of products, expand across Africa, got selected as one of the Google startups in the accelerator, which I think is quite exciting. And then another one I'll mention is called Good Loans. So they were founded in the UK by sort of a Ghanaian, Nigerian, British person. Yeah, quite interesting background. But the idea is that they are really trying to help to fund microfinance institutions that have generally been undercapitalized, partly due to the capital structure that you have, where most microfinance banks and institutions find their capital either from their deposits, but also through on lending facilities from commercial banks. And that can end up being quite pricey, just given, you know, the current cost of capital. So they're trying to disrupt that using technology, using AI, and then, of course, less expensive pools of capital from all of the world using more decentralized finance. And so those are some of the ones that I'll mention. I think there's probably like two or three others somewhere in the portfolio. One is, I think, technically not in operations. We'll see what happens with that processing company. But yeah, the rest are doing pretty well.
Okay, that's interesting. All right, so you mentioned that a lot of your experience has been in the agricultural space, and you've also invested in fintech, at least one or two fintech startups. So here's the thing, we have most of the funding coming into Africa going to fintech startups, and there's a lot of problems that could be solved in the agricultural space, but startups in that space are not getting as much money. So that's not the only sector, by the way. There are actually a lot of other sectors. So why do you think fintech startups find it, or at least on the surface, it looks like they find it a lot easier to raise money than startups in other sectors?
A good one, and I'll clarify a bit. My experience is definitely very deep in agriculture, but I worked across many different sectors. So I've done work in health, I've done work in education, I've done work in energy, I've done work in the creative economy, and a whole range of others. And I think part of that is because it was at the time that I was living and working across East and West Africa, somewhat tricky to be a specialist in a strategy consulting firm that had so many different projects. So in a way, I ended up being a generalist. I would say a specialist in agri, specialist in Nigeria, a specialist in access to financial services, and probably a few others, just because of the depth of project work. Oh, I know. What else can you do? I would say what I do know very, very well is the mass market and or base of pyramid consumer, and that is both rural and urban. And I think why fintech is so exciting is because there were so many gaps to fix in financial services across the continent. If you simply start with, there are still many countries across the continent that do not have switches, like we have in Nigeria with NIBS, where you can actually send money from one bank to another bank and it will actually be settled nearly immediately. That doesn't exist yet in a country like Sierra Leone and many others. They're still working on that type of technology. So you can imagine, if you're now trying to do a cross-border transaction, how long will it actually take to settle and clear? You can imagine if you're trying to send money from one part of a country to another part of a country. So I think, in a way, there were large problems to be solved. I think a lot of the infrastructure is being built by fintechs rather than by, you know, governments or some of the larger corporates. And I think those are always very exciting to me. But you also have, I think, a lot of excitement where there is money, obviously. So, and I think that's that's why there's a lot of people interested in becoming bankers or interested in their children becoming bankers, because it's like, well, that's where there's money. And I think in a way, to some extent, fintech has that same attractiveness. And then I would also say that if you're looking at investing in a high growth company, let's say in healthcare, it is much more tricky to establish how well they're performing by only looking at the numbers, right? You actually have to go and see, okay, they're probably not fully digital, just given the status of our healthcare systems. So they have partnerships with clinics or with laboratories or with pharmacies. So you then have to go talk to those pharmacies and go engage with them in person and see physically with your own eyes the infrastructure and the asset base that is, you know, backs their partners. And I think with fintech, and maybe this is being too harsh, but I think with fintech, it is easier to conduct diligence at the surface level, meaning you see huge growth month over month in the revenue run rate, in the client numbers, in the loans disbursed, and that can obviously be very interesting and exciting, and perhaps easier to value, especially now we have so many comparables across Africa, Asia, Latin America that you can look at, compared to an investment in a potentially high growth logistics company or health or ed tech, as it were. So I think that is part of it. However, I think only investing in fintech in Africa does miss out on the fact that fintech alone is a really small pool of what's really possible with financial services on the continent. So you can imagine that banking, you would want banking to actually follow, let's say, the sectoral GDP makeup in a country. So you would want that bank is banking agriculture, it's banking consumer, it's banking, you know, oil and gas, where we have that in Nigeria. And you oftentimes see, and we see this in financial institutions, in traditional financial institutions, they'll focus on the sectors that are sort of the easiest to bank. It's why there's been a big push over the last decade for traditional financial institutions to move into sectors like agriculture, where, you know, prior to years ago, it was like 1 or 2% of total bank lending was to agriculture, which is clearly very different to what agriculture's contribution is to GDP. And so I think you're always going to see some challenges if you see like the easiest to bank, for example, meaning the rural is off the table, agri might be off the table, even semi-urban might be off the table. If you find that there are urban customers with high transaction volumes and values who are already banked by traditional financial institutions, layering on payment services that maybe are faster or lower cost is going to be attractive. But I would say it's really only tapping into a very, very, very small percent of the market. So if you're excited by Nigeria's 200 million plus population, then only looking at urban, you know, already banked financial services and in fintech is probably not capturing that massive opportunity size that's out there. Okay. And I know you asked about agriculture, but I think I had to just make some comments about why fintech is, of course, still very exciting, but potentially not as exciting for me as other sectors. I think there are linkages to financial services in every single sector. So if you look at ag, if you look at logistics, if you look at consumer, if you look at health, there are so many financial services that are required. including payments, but also in terms of what we're calling now embedded finance. So how do you actually finance the operators and players that are driving economies? I think there's so much to do there, and that's where I'm very excited. And so if you only do quote unquote fintech, but don't get to know these other sectors that are driving the economy, I think we end up missing out. I think people are starting to see this with investments that we're seeing in the retail tech or B2B retail tech. So the Twigas and Soko Watch, Alerzo, Omnibiz of the world, and one of our portfolio companies, Sabi. But I think it goes far beyond that as well.
Okay. So let's look at when startups are ready for these investments. So we have a lot of startups who opt to raise money. We also have a few. We don't really hear much about them, so it's really difficult to say how many there are. But we still have a few that prefer to bootstrap to a certain level. So when would you say a startup is ready for VC investment?
Yeah, I would say the majority of startups are not ever going to get VC investment. And as you can imagine, you know, right now, globally, Africa has less than 1% of total VC investment last year. And we have so many startups. And I think, you know, yes, more money is coming into the sector, but I would say the majority of startups are really not VC investable. And so startups that are VC investable, I think probably have to start having a conversation about what's their vision, how quickly do they want to grow, and are they ready for that, you know, quote unquote, rocket ship growth trajectory that is expected over the 5 to 10 year holding period that a venture capital fund is looking for. Is the company really poised to make those investments, whether that's in team, technology, and marketing, in order to really get to that next level of growth? I think those are all things to really consider. Are they ready for, you know, the type of diligence that some of the funds are doing, where you're actually really looking quite deeply into the business to better understand the customer experience, the team experience, the governance of the company? Are they ready to have external board members? Because oftentimes when you're very early stage, you don't really have, maybe you have some advisors that you talk to, but having sort of a board that to some extent you're reporting to, that are looking out for the shareholders' interests, I think is a big shift to that next level of professionalization and growth. And then of course, are they ready to go and tell the story? Fortunately or unfortunately, this type of high growth companies oftentimes require multiple rounds of funding. So it's not just that you go out and raise venture capital and then you know, can sit back for the next 5 years and just grow the business. Oftentimes, in order to meet these type of growth objectives, and specifically to get closer to EBITDA positive, if you're not already EBITDA positive, then you're going to have to go out and raise funding. And that requires either on the founding team or somebody that's brought in to be able to talk to investors and really tell the story of the company, of the vision, of why the product is really the one to back.
All right, so you just mentioned that not every startup in Africa will be backed by VCs. So how many startups do you typically say no to in a month at this level?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I would say we say no to the majority of startups that we see in any given month, but I would say we're seeing thousands of companies every year. And we're, you know, our strategy is of a high conviction strategy. And my partner, Jeff, has written about this about a year ago, where we like to lead rounds. We like to, you know, in a prior time, be the first institutional check. And I'd say now be one of the first institutional checks into a company. We like to take board seats and support companies to that next stage of growth, whether that's getting them to sort of internal milestones, EBITDA positive, to their Series A and future rounds. And so because of that, we don't invest in hundreds of companies every year. We would probably invest in a smaller number of companies. And so what that ends up meaning is we do have to say no quite a lot. But I think even the funds that are investing in, you know, tens or hundreds of companies in a year are saying no to the majority of deals that they're seeing. There are just so many more deals than any fund can invest in. And even those that are investing in quite a wide swath of companies. And I think that can be challenging for a whole host of reasons. I talk a lot about diversity in venture, and we talked about this as one of the points that I brought up, what's so different between what I was doing previously in venture. But I think what can end up happening is that you end up seeing a transaction that maybe is different than the others that you might have been looking at. And sometimes that can be undervalued, partly because it's perhaps in a sector that you're not as familiar with, or because the founding team has a woman. And as we know, women are generally underinvested in an African VC and global VC. And so I think that can be a challenge, no matter how many companies that you're investing in, and something that we have to be really deliberate about. But sadly, we have to say no to the vast majority of companies that we're looking at.
So when a startup comes, submits an interest or makes their interest to be funded, not to a VC, VCs typically conduct due diligence. So we're going to talk about what the due diligence process looks like. But first of all, what do you think that startup founders should look out for when choosing investors? Because investors are significant parts of what happens in the business. So what should they look out for when they are choosing these investors?
Yeah, okay. In terms of choosing investors, the startups are really in charge of who comes onto their cap table. And so I think it is a significant amount of power. And I think that's a good thing, especially given how much new capital is coming into the ecosystem, funds that are being raised. Especially when the startup is, you know, in some of these high growth sectors, I think they do have like quite the pick of which investors they want in the cap table. And I think it's about what sectors the investor has invested in, or what's their experience in the sector that the startup is in, what's the network that this individual investor or the team has on the continent, whether that's with government, private companies, potential acquirers, etc. I think all of that is really critical. Do they have Africa expertise, lived experience, and that sort of expertise that can really contribute, whether it's from a managerial or a governance perspective or otherwise? I think that's really one that stands out. And then I think the other one is, do they have the financial capacity to support you in this round or future rounds? I think particularly for the high growth sectors, there's a question about whether or not companies can raise not just this round, but the next round. And can this investor actually go with you on the journey? Do they know other investors that can come in and support you on that journey? I think all of those are really critical as well. And then depending on the type of founder you are, I think you always want to have at least one investor that will be quite, you know, hands-on and support your mission, vision, understand, you know, your reporting, help you think about how to build your team, think through some of the governance questions. So you want to look for an investor that can, even amongst other investors that maybe aren't going to play that lead role, play a lead role as well. I think the other one and the final one would be around finding Africa-based and focused investors. I've seen a number of rounds recently where it's primarily international investors, especially at like a seed or pre-seed round. I think it's a question about whether or not that opportunity is going to be able to attract the later rounds of capital and really execute without those type of partners who know the market very well. So I think those are all things that I would think about. So, you know, who do you want on your cap table to sort of join you in this journey? What's their funding availability and ability to really join you on that journey? And Africa experience and expertise, which can really help to grow and scale a company.
Okay, so let's move to the due diligence process. It's an important part of the process before VCs make investments. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so I'd say for us, it's pretty rigorous. And that's at the seed and pre-seed level where we've just started investing over the last 6 months, or at a Series A or pre-Series A bridge to Series B where we've traditionally been investing. So we've invested in about 24 companies across East and West Africa, including some SPV deals before our first fund, and then across our other funds. And I'd say we really want to know a company, where it is now, but also where it's heading. Where it is now is all about who's the team, who's the founder, what's the founding team makeup, how gender diverse is that team, how geographically diverse is that team, what type of Africa experience and specific experience to the problem the company is trying to solve. And then we always want to understand from our perspective, why is this problem interesting? Not just from a, it exists, but what's the size of market that this company is actually addressing? What's the addressable market, and how is this company going to be well positioned to address that? So we will understand market research. We'll talk to people in the market. We may talk to other firms at different stages in the value chain around the investment activity. We will talk to investors and companies in other markets to better understand the opportunity and perhaps where it can scale to. And then, of course, we'll spend time with the team. We really want to get to know them, how they operate, how they make decisions, how well they really understand this problem they're trying to solve, what they are like as a manager of people. So all of those are things that we'll try to understand of where the company is now. And then, of course, the financials. So how have they been performing since they were founded? Have there been any pivots? How were they able to manage those pivots? What's the cash situation? And especially where they're raising around, what's the what we call runway that they'll have post-investment. So this is let's say 1 year of our costs that will ensure that in a year we'll probably have to raise more money, or in a year we'll be at this level in terms of our scale and growth that would be able to attract this kind of capital. And do we think that that's achievable and believable given what we've seen about the historical? And then in the future looking part of it, it's really about what's the strategy that the company has to achieve that next stage of scale and growth. And do we think that that's appropriate for the market and the challenge? Does that include geographic expansion, or does that include moving into other customer segments? Does it mean launching new products and services, and how challenging is that? Is the company poised to address those challenges and really deliver on those areas? And to some extent, how have we seen companies like this evolve in other markets, I think is also a helpful data point to see if that's in line with how this company is thinking. And then, of course, what team is going to be required going forward to make all of this happen? So ideally, they've identified, if not candidates, profiles of people that they think they're going to need, especially on the senior team, to go to the next level of growth.
That's a very detailed process. So what's the factors you think make a startup more likely to succeed?
I mean, I think it comes down to the team and really understanding their customer. And so that's what we call the product market fit. I think if you have a great idea, even if you have product market fit, you might not be able to really get the company to the next level of scale to take full advantage of that market opportunity. And so, and vice versa, if you have a great team, but the product is not right, you're not also going to be able to take advantage of that product market fit. So I think those two for me are the most critical. And so as you have an idea for a company, I think you as a founder, you have to really understand what are your strengths, what are the challenges that you think you'll have in building a venture scalable business. And if you are looking at raising venture capital, What team members are you going to have to bring in order to really support you on that journey? Because not everyone is going to be a technical founder. Even if you are a technical founder, you might not be great at finance. Even if you are great at finance, you might not be great at people management. And so what are the things that you are not bringing to the table? I think that has to be a really important conversation across the founder or co-founding team. So I think that's probably one. And then also on the team is, how does this scale over time? Do we have the skill set in our team to really lead this business through the next 5 or 10 years of growth? And if not, what are we going to do in order to bring in the right people at different stages of the company's growth in order to get us there? And we've seen this with some companies where you've had, you know, CEO departures, or you've had, maybe you have a finance manager or finance analyst at the start, but within a year or two, it's really clear you need a finance director or a CFO. And so I think we've seen over time that companies need to make these type of investments in people to ensure that they are able to really get to that next level of growth. And then on the customer side and product market fit, I think it really is understanding at the starting point, who are those core customers that you're really trying to serve? And then how do you serve them more deeply, serve them better, provide more value back to that customer, or think about other customers that could also want to use this product, whether they're out of your geography or otherwise. But all of those changes and shifts have cost implications. So then finally, it's, you know, yes, achieving this product market fit and getting income from that and making sure that you're not overspending in order to achieve that, in order to get more customers on board.
So my next question is going to be like a prediction. I was going to ask you to make a prediction for the next 10 years of investments in Africa and the startup space in Africa, but I read that you don't generally make like very long term projections. So let's do 5 years instead.
Oh man, I'm not a planner, you know. There are people who write down these 5-year plans and life plans.
Yeah.
I actually looked back in this article that you'll see at some point. I did find my like 10-year life plan thing from this event that I did in 2016, I think. So I was shocked. I was like, oh, well, actually, that might have been helpful to write it down. So maybe it is useful to make these kind of futuristic projections about what we want to see, even if it might not happen. So what I would like to see, I would like to see more funds investing in women-founded and owned startups. I really think that there is no longer an excuse. The global data exists. I think in time, the Africa data will exist, that the women-owned businesses that are receiving venture are doing just as well, if not better, than the male-owned and founded companies that are receiving venture. And so I think we have to really move away from historical patterns and biased patterns of capital allocation. Honestly, I would be shocked if we'd made a very big dent in the next 5 to 10 years. And I think part of it is because there are not enough men saying the words that I have just said. There are very few, from what I've seen, in the ecosystem of investors really understanding that there is a missed opportunity in investing in women-owned and founded companies. And so I think until we have more men saying this and doing this and acting this out in their investment process, in their investment strategy, as they assess a company, I don't think we're going to get there. I also think, similar to what we're seeing on the gender side, we are seeing that at the country level, we're seeing that at the subnational level, and my hope is that we start to see the emergence of these ecosystems that are beyond the top 4 countries, so Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, and Egypt. I hope that we start to see investment outside of Nairobi, outside of Lagos, outside of Cairo, outside of Joburg and Cape Town. There are other cities, there are other tech ecosystems and startup ecosystems outside of the primary cities. And I hope that we get to see more investment, not just the one, you know, or the two coming out of, you know, whatever other country geography that's currently underserved. So I think there's a lot of untapped opportunity and startups and founders that are operating in truly underserved markets where venture capital is not currently touching. And that's where I'm very passionate about and where I'm very excited about investing into. And then my hope is that we continue to have conversations about governance, about equity and theirs around, you know, how can employees really participate in the upside. I think it's very exciting to me that there are so many African founded companies, but if, you know, 70% of venture capital is coming from the US, I think we could really miss out on an opportunity to generate wealth for Africans. And so my hope is that more Africans invest, whether that's high net worth individuals or young professionals, but also people who are in companies who make it, I hope they are also able to generate wealth for themselves and invest back into other companies, into their communities, because I think if we're not going to do it, I don't think we can expect others to do that. So those are probably what I would like to see happen. I think if you think of a projection, there's a lot of excitement in Africa. And as I said, we're still so underserved. We are less than 1% of total venture capital. Even if you just look from a GDP perspective or from like a growth rate perspective over the last decade, we should have more capital coming into Africa. And I think we are going to continue to see that. We have so many funds being raised. I think the question is going to be, can the funds that are raising, can they really get to that next stage of growth and scale? Can they really demonstrate the multiple exits over the course of time? And so my hope is that we are going to see that over the next 10 years. So more exits that really demonstrate that African businesses can get to scale that's attractive to African and global investors for exits, where we start to see more strategic acquisitions and partnerships across East, West, North, Southern, and Central Africa, and where we see more African fund managers really owning assets on the continent. I think those are all my future wishes and hopes that I want to see for venture and for private investing in Africa.
All right, so fingers crossed. Hopefully all of this happens. So in 5 years time, I think we can check back to see which one of the predictions or your hopes actually came to pass.
Yes, my hopes. We'll call them hopes.
Yeah, for lack of a better word, let's see which one of them gets to happen. All right, so final question before we go. A lot of founders are going to listen to this episode. So they could want invested what they are investing them to. What kind of founders do you look out for and how can they reach you?
Yeah, so we look out for founders who are investing in companies that are going to change Africa's trajectory from a socioeconomic development perspective, from a human capital perspective. So we invest in agribusiness, and we're particularly excited in agribusiness and companies that are probably pre-Series A into the Series A, who have, you know, worked through some of the farming risks that can exist if they're doing primary production and have started to really test out their processing capacity if they're in processing, ideally without significant amount of debt on the balance sheet, just given some of the challenges that can exist in that sector. I think in consumer, somewhat similarly, we're really excited about companies that have demonstrated that product market fit, that have a following, if you will, whether that's by customers and having a very clear product offering, and so probably are more at that pre-Series A level.
We're obviously in both of these. We have generally gotten to know companies over the course of up to even 2 years before we make an investment. So always happy to see companies at an early stage, even if it's not a fit right now, and we'll sort of follow their progress over time. And then in enabling technology, it's obviously a very broad bucket, but we are really excited by a number of the demographic shifts that we're seeing on the continent. So that's everything from the youth bulge and this question about how do we create and sustainable jobs for youth. It's about, you know, the fact that we have significant amounts of mobile connectivity and increased mobile connectivity, but still pockets of very disconnected populations across the continent. We're seeing huge rates of urbanization in the target geographies that we're excited about. And so how do you provide urban services like transportation and logistics, like healthcare, like education in these highly urbanized settings with limited government services? So we're excited about a lot of themes within that, but I would say the broader enabling technology, we would like to see not just pure tech plays, but plays that are actually solving challenges that Africans are facing on a day-to-day basis. And you'll see from our portfolio, like, this is the type of companies that we're excited about. We generally invest in Nigeria, Ghana, and Kenya. We've also made some investments in Uganda and Rwanda. We still have Tanzania and Ethiopia as secondary markets that we can invest in, although we see ourselves as an Africa-focused fund, East and West. We're happy to look at opportunities outside of that that will be moving into our focus markets. So one of our investment companies, for example, was based outside of those markets, but Nigeria and Kenya were two of their largest markets. And so that would make sense, where we can actually help them think about expanding and partnerships within these markets that we know very deeply. The best way to reach me, I think, it's probably either over email, LinkedIn, or Twitter. I think of all of those, LinkedIn is probably the best. I'm trying to be more active there. And then my email is neka@vestedworld.com. Vested World is just one word, VestedWorld.com. And then I think my Twitter, I even know my handle? It's @neka_eze. So you'll have to find me that way. I'm pretty sure if you Google Neka, Twitter, Vested World, something will come up. So you'll be able to reach me there as well.
I'll link to your social profiles in the description so that you'll save the listeners the time.
Oh, great. Oh, no worries, Jim Glazer, and thank you as well for the conversation. It's been great to reflect, and I really do hope we see these hopes and wishes come true. And thank you for what you're doing to make that happen as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me today on the podcast. But before we go, it's 2 things. Please share and like this episode. You can also catch up with previous episodes at equitymerchants.show.